March 1973, the Sahara. There was no road and certainly no GPS. Forward motion meant following a dusty track. Occasionally, through the haze, the family had seen a lone gazelle or a few people on camels. Every now and then, they had discovered a village. For the last 3 days, however, they had encountered no one but themselves. Drought and daytime temperatures touching 120 degrees Fahrenheit made the area almost uninhabitable. Now, at 4 in the afternoon, they came to a split in the track and didn't know which way to go. John, hair white, his bald spot susceptible to sunburn, wearing professorial black-framed glasses, drove one dark green Land Rover. Anne, an athletic redhead, accompanied him, or Nigel, their 17-year-old son, who drove the other. Luggage, tents, bedding, food, a cook stove, and other supplies for the trip lined every free inch of the vehicle's interiors. In the back seats, Megan, 14 years old, and Christopher, 10, couldn't touch their feet to floors packed with flat-sided 5-gallon metal jerry cans. The ones with water were still full, though sloshing, the children heard. The ones with gas, already partly empty, seemed to make a louder sound. Let them accidentally clank against each other and they might echo ominously. The adults conferred about which trail to follow. Megan, who wanted to be an anthropologist, passed the time imagining what it would be like to live where they were going. Chris, the family navigator, brushed overgrown brown bangs from his eyes and studied yet again the only map of their terrain. Drawn by French surveyors at a scale of 1 centimeter to 40 kilometers, the map depicted the desert in mustard yellow. Every morning and evening before breaking camp or bedding down for the night, the boy ran to lead his father and older brother in unfolding it for reference atop the hood of a Land Rover. Tiny symbols, an X, an empty square, a stick figure house, marked possible stops for gas, repairs, and primitive lodging. Au bon à 5 mètres. Good water at 5 or 15 or 35 meters. Little notes suggested along the route. Of the unmarked trails they followed, Chris read, "Suitable only for cross-country vehicles and certain types of truck. To use them, a guide or means of land navigation is necessary. Traveling with only one car, inadvisable." Chris, dressed in a short-sleeved collared shirt and shorts, was noticeably thin, all knees and elbows. At home in Golden Valley, Minnesota, his parents had tried to fatten him up with eggnog and ice cream. His energy and diligence, however, made his presence larger. "Knowing where you were was a big thing," he would say years later. "Crossing the Sahara, it's a matter of life and death." Now, carefully double-checking their whereabouts, he calculated that their next fuel stop was not for 500 kilometers. The family decided to drive left. Sweating, they spent an hour traversing rough chunks of rock down into a valley or gorge. Then dunes, nearly liquid in the heat. Standing at the edge of an escarpment, the Murrays could see no more track below them. They went back, exploring the other side. Finally, the path was pure, loose sand. Wrangling sand ladders, 6-by-2-foot metal boards full of holes under buried tires, they returned to the original split. In England, John, the intellectual, had bought a compass. Now Chris berated him for not using it. Instead, as the sun set, they prepared to wait as long as necessary for a fellow traveler of whom they could ask directions. A guide, which was supposed to be Chris's job. "He made some pretty nasty comments," John defended himself decades later, "but we didn't know what the sand was like. If we had gone off, we could have been lost in it." This was how the Murray family arrived in Africa. The hard part was yet to come.